filming and lived in San Clemente with her family. Every day, she made the 2-hour round-trip drive up from Orange County for filming. She had been making this drive now for months, starting with casting and rehearsals, and she was never late. She'd always wanted to be an actress, but having a family waylaid her aspiration. When her kids got old enough to go to college, she started looking around again, booked a few small parts, eventually became frustrated, and cooled down. She still kept an eye out for opportunities, but there were few and far between. Then, in Backstage West, she saw an audition announcement for The Room. Carolyn, too, was a pro. She never complained, did exactly as she was told, even if that included a scene in which her character announced that she had breast cancer with no apparent concern, and delivered one of the more coherent performances in The Room. It helped, I think, that Tommy was unusually considerate when dealing with Carolyn. He never barked at her. Maybe this was because she, like he, was trying to fulfill a later-in-life dream of movie stardom. Or maybe she just made him feel younger. Carolyn was quiet, and I think a little embarrassed as we drove to the hospital. She laughed when she told me what line she said right before she fainted. "If you think I'm tired today, wait until you see me tomorrow." I checked her in at Cedars-Sinai. The ER nurse said, "What are you doing at your age, passing out in the heat?" Carolyn sighed. "I'm working on a movie," she said. "You poor thing," the nurse said. "Well, that movie of yours should have air conditioning." When we returned to the condo set, Tommy and Sandy were having an unusually vociferous argument. It began when Tommy referred to Sandy as his assistant and told Sandy to let him do the director job, which, quite understandably, made Sandy angry. "No, no, no, Tommy," Sandy was saying. "I'm not your assistant. And I'm telling you, this scene is just, this is ridiculous. It's totally, totally ridiculous." "No, it's not," Tommy said. "It's how I want it." "That doesn't mean it's not ridiculous." When I approached them, Sandy looked over at me with an all praise God you're back expression. Sandy mistakenly believed that Tommy listened to me. At issue was the fact that Lisa begins the scene talking to her mother on the phone and ends by walking her to the door. Yet, somehow, their entire conversation gets recorded on Johnny and Lisa's answering machine? Tommy was adamant that the answering machine record the conversation so that, in the next scene, Johnny can find the tape on which Lisa admits she's having an affair. Tommy had been alerted to the rather intractable space-time conundrum the scene created, but he was fixated on having Johnny find the recorded conversation. In the end, Tommy decided to shoot the scene so that Johnny overhears Lisa and Claudette's conversation from the condo's spiral staircase. Then, when Lisa and Claudette leave the scene, Tommy wanted Johnny to proceed to the phone and hook it up to a tape recorder. I'll start with the most obvious problem. The living room set was 15 feet across. Johnny would have had as much luck hiding from Lisa and Claudette on the staircase as he would lying at their feet. An only slightly smaller problem was the method by which Johnny sought to record his future wife's future conversations. Bugging a phone generally takes a little more effort than plugging it into a yard sale tape recorder, and you need a different kind of tape than a 90-minute Maxell, which Johnny, of course, happens to already have in his shirt pocket. None of it made any sense, but this was what Tommy wanted to shoot. Some crew guys were setting up the coverage shot of the tape recorder when I came in. "You can't shoot that," Graham told Tommy. "Sandy's right." Tommy was wholly unruffled by their concerns. "We shoot like this, how we want." "How you want," Sandy said. "I don't want to shoot it this way. You don't need to have Johnny record anything. You already have him overhearing the conversation." It was an undeniable point. Johnny hears his future wife admit she's having an affair. Does he now need proof he has proof? "I disagree," Tommy said. In interviews about The Room, Tommy always shows an unusual amount of defensiveness about Johnny's tape recorder surveillance of Lisa. He maintains that Johnny's method is a legitimate way to record telephone conversations. Tommy believes this because, in his personal life, he has taped his own phone calls for years using similarly low-tech techniques. Whenever anyone called him, including me, he put the call on speaker and hit record on the same yard sale tape recorder he now wanted to film. This was why he always said, "I'm listening," whenever I called. He was listening. He was also recording. I know all this because I eventually found a huge cache of tapes with hours and hours of phone calls on them, some of which were ours. I confronted him. He denied it at first. When he realized he couldn't deny it, he claimed he'd done this to study my accent in order to lose his own. I told him that didn't sound like a very plausible explanation, and from then on, I hung up on him if he ever put me on speaker. Then he became paranoid that I was taping him. Whenever we were on the phone, he would repeatedly ask me, "Does anybody listen to this conversation?" "Fine," Sandy said, dabbing at his sweaty forehead with a handkerchief. "I'm too hot to argue anymore. Let's just shoot the thing." When Tommy walked away, Sandy said to me, "Nobody's going to see this movie anyway." The first task was to shoot Tommy on the condo set spiral staircase while he looks down at Claudette and Lisa as they have their conversation 10 feet away from him. Tommy wanted to be filmed through the bars of the staircase, which made him look like an imprisoned long-haired Kong. "This doesn't work," Sandy said, watching the setup from behind the camera. I overheard Graham say to his cameraman that if someone had told him about Tommy, he would have refused to believe that such a filmmaker could exist. Once they got the eyeline set, Tommy went off to makeup for the fifth time that day. Graham started looking around the room. "What's the deal with all these candles?" he asked. "And what's with these red curtains? Why does the CD tower have only 3 CDs in it? Who on earth decorated this set?" He might as well have said, "The candles, the music, the sexy dress, what's going on here?" No one answered Graham, which was all the answer Graham needed. His shoulders sagged as Tommy placed himself on the spiral staircase again. He started to film, but Tommy couldn't stand still. He kept bobbing, moving, and messing up the shot's composition. "Stop moving, please," Graham said. "I'm not moving," Tommy said. They tried it again. Again, Tommy was moving. "Please stop moving," Graham said through clenched teeth. Eventually, Tommy stopped moving, but now came the acting part. This is what Tommy had to say. "How could they say this about me? I don't believe it. I'll show them. I'll record everything." Yet again, Tommy's humble, self-scripted lines proved too much for him. After an hour of blown takes, botched lines, and Tommy's calls for line, Graham asked someone to write the lines down on a large piece of paper and hold them up so Tommy could read them. If you watch this scene carefully, you can see Tommy's eyes scan the impromptu cue card being held up before him. Once we finally got the shot, Graham turned to me and said, "He wrote this, right?" "He did. Just checking." Now came time to shoot the scene in which Johnny crosses the living room to set up the phone tap tape recorder, which for some reason had already been placed in a nook beneath Johnny's end table. Sandy made the mistake of telling Tommy to be cautious not to hit his head on the way down the stairs, which meant that the first 10 takes coming down had all the briskness and surety of a grandmother carrying a Ming vase. When they finally got a somewhat usable take of Tommy coming down the stairs, he had to be told to continue walking across the room to the phone, at which point Tommy started making what the crew instantly designated the face. I knew the face for what it really was: blue steel. Tommy has always been fascinated with models and pretty clearly believes he should be one. In fact, earlier that day, Before everything went crazy and Carolyn fainted, I saw him looking at a Calvin Klein ad in GQ while getting his second round of makeup done. "You think I could do the modeling?" he asked me, holding the magazine out. I wasn't sure how honest he wanted me to be. "Sure, why not?" I said. Tommy spent the rest of his time in the makeup chair going from studying the Calvin Klein ad to pursing his lips in the mirror. Let's explore Tommy's decision to blue steel at this particular moment in the story. Johnny has just learned that his future wife is cheating on him. He's devastated and upset, presumably. This was Johnny's time for sobriety and doubt. It was not his time to explode with sexuality. "What's with the duck lip thing he's doing?" someone asked quietly, as Tommy vamped his way across the room. "What the hell is he doing?" Simple. Tommy decided to have Johnny respond to the shattering news that his future wife is banging another guy with some blue steel. Later in the day, during close-up shots for Tommy's actual assembly of his tape recorder wiretap, he gave the most incredible blue steel I think I've ever seen. Graham and the people he'd brought in were stupefied at this point. It was as though they'd been called in to do a simple nature film and found themselves confronted with the Loch Ness Monster. Getting Tommy back across the room and up the stairs was the most difficult portion of this sequence. Sandy had to talk him through the entire thing. When Tommy looked back at the tape recorder triumphantly, nodding in amazed self-admiration at the genius of his wiretap, Sandy said, "Why are you looking back? Keep going! Don't look back!" Tommy reached the stairs and climbed them at such a glacial pace. It looked as if Johnny had never been in his own house before. When Tommy finished, he clearly thought that he'd just delivered a masterclass in dramatic acting. He approached me, smiling. "You think you can do it," he said, "and I can't, huh? Don't worry, I may be model too. I don't know yet. Maybe I'll try it. Maybe do underwear modeling. Maybe design my own underwear. What about that?" I didn't point out to him that Juliet and Carolyn managed to film their conversation in less time than it took to film Tommy walking across a room. And that included the time it took Carolyn to visit and return from the hospital. Graham and his crew shot for several more days in the punishing heat of Johnny and Lisa's condo set. Among the scenes they filmed were the master shots of a conversation shared by Johnny and Peter, Johnny's psychologist friend, in which Johnny admits that Lisa has not been loyal to him. As usual, it took Tommy an entire afternoon to get a few clean takes, and Graham was getting less and less patient with him. Graham was particularly unhappy with the moment in which Johnny says, "You know what they say, love is blind." The best take they had of that line was all mumbly and garbled, and it needed to be done again. Tommy saw this as an opportunity to earn his Oscar. He buttonholed Sandy and said, "Listen, this is very important scene. I want camera very close on my face, very close, so you can see the eyes. This is dramatic scene for the character." Sandy was so beaten down by this point that if Tommy had come to him and said, "I want to shoot this scene with unicorns in the background," Sandy would have said, "Yeah, sure, sounds great." Graham didn't like the sound of this close-up business, and I liked it even less after looking at some of the test shots. "I don't know, Tommy, it's kind of scaring me. You look a little possessed." Tommy, though, was bothered by something else in the test shots. "Makeup artist," he said, turning from the monitor, "I need you here. Look at this scene. I don't want to have the lines on my face. See? What is this thing on my face?" Amy, the makeup artist, looked at him. I'm pretty sure she wanted to say, "That's called reality, Tommy." "I don't like this puffy stuff," he said, touching the area under his eyes. She got him into the makeup chair and went to work getting rid of the puffy stuff. Don't pull down on my face, Tommy said, jerking. Be gentle, my God. She rolled her eyes and kept doing exactly what she was doing. Okay, thank you. More powder now. More powder, please. Kyle Vogt, who was playing Peter the psychologist, approached Tommy during this depuffication session. He'd made it very clear to Tommy, when he was hired months ago, that he had a commitment to another project that had priority over the room. Tommy had assured Kyle that the room would wrap before Kyle's other project began. Kyle's project was on the eve of starting, and his scenes in the room were not anywhere close to being finished. Tommy, Kyle said, I have to tell you that this is probably going to be my last scene. I can't work anymore on this because of my other commitment. Tommy's eyes were closed while the makeup artist powdered him. Now they popped open, like those of a sleeping dragon whose treasure had been snatched. In the original script, Peter was one of the room's most prominent characters, with more scenes than, say, Claudette. Why, Tommy said to Kyle, do you try to ruin my project? This is unacceptable. He was going for hard-hearted menace here, but that proved impossible to pull off when someone was dabbing at his face with a small foam cube covered in powder. Kyle held his ground. Tommy, I told you about this. You knew about this months ago. Tommy sat there, sneering and breathing. You know what? He said after a moment. That's fine. You leave, don't come back. We don't need you anyway. It's your loss. You and your stupid Warner Brothers. They spit on you at Warner Brothers. The project Kyle was leaving for was, in fact, an indie film. Kyle had never said anything about going to do a film for Warner Brothers. He worked for Warner Music, though, which a confused Tommy had obviously latched onto. Kyle tried to make things right with Tommy, using reason, but Tommy just sank into silent, powdery sullenness. Eventually, Kyle left him alone. Kyle, like most of us, saw the room as a vanity project intended to promote Tommy and Tommy alone. By this point, he didn't think the film would get finished. It all must have felt very silly to Kyle, especially considering that his previous job was working for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Lab. Whatever the case, he and Tommy now had to act together. Kyle was obviously upset and off his game, and while blocking the scene, he smacked his head hard against one of the spiral staircase's low-jutting stairs. Blood gushed from his head, which caused Tommy to panic once again. Many people have wondered why Kyle blinks so much during this scene, and why he reaches out to touch so many props. The explanation is that he had a concussion, and his depth perception was a mess. It's impressive that he was able to perform at all. He does not, however, make a very convincing psychologist. Tommy claimed to be fascinated by psychology. He once mentioned having seen a psychologist or psychiatrist. He had no idea there was any difference between the two, and suggested it had been a positive experience. He supposedly studied psychology at Laney College and had the relevant textbooks stacked up in his messy apartment, but whether he had actually read any of them, I have no idea. It's worth pointing out that Peter's psychologist wisdom to Johnny ranges from cliche, people are people, to obvious, this is Lisa we're talking about, to terrible. If you love her, you should confront her. Peter is one of the most oddly inconsistent characters in the room. His firm and resolute opinions on Lisa change completely depending on which scene he's in. At one moment, he can't believe a woman as saintly as Lisa would ever cheat. Minutes later, he calls her a sociopath. Watching Tommy perform the scene, I wondered what his psychologist or psychiatrist had made of him. I tried to imagine Tommy's mind from the inside out. I saw burning forests, blind alleys, volcanoes in the desert, city streets that plunged into the ocean, barricades everywhere, and all of it lit in the deep cherry light of emergency. Graham was growing increasingly upset. The production had needed a generator for weeks now, because every time a piece of equipment ran out of juice, everyone had to wait for its operator to plug it in and recharge. If Tommy had had a generator on set, they could have filmed to their heart's delirious content. The production was losing hours every day due to the lack of a generator, which could be rented for around $200 a day. But the man who was spending $500,000 shooting an HD film he wasn't going to use could not be bothered with such a peasant's expense. Graham had been asking for a generator daily, and Tommy kept telling him he'd work on it. During the Peter-Johnny scene, everything began to weigh on Graham. The heat, Tommy's flub lines, Kyle's excessive blinking, the way the water sounded when Johnny poured it into a glass. He seemed to be losing his mind a little. I think what was actually happening was that he was beginning to understand what it meant that his name was going to be attached to this film. I knew the feeling. "Let's shoot something outside," he said to Tommy and Sandy after the Peter scene was finished. "Let's get out of the set. It's too hot and I'm going nuts with claustrophobia." Sandy suggested shooting the rooftop party scene, which takes place near the end of the film. "A night shoot," he said, "might be nice." Tommy, though, wanted to shoot something else, something inside. Graham made him a deal. If Tommy got a generator, they could shoot inside again, just as Tommy wanted. Tommy agreed. Graham gave him the number of two good generator places, and Tommy said he'd call. After a long weekend break, Tommy pulled into the Burns and Sawyer lot to find Graham sitting on an apple box by the rooftop. Tommy had come on his own, quite tardy, of course, saying he had had a dailies meeting with producers. Graham's crew was there, too, waiting with him. Tommy was supposed to have called about a generator, but I knew he hadn't. Tommy got out of his car, looking agitated, and walked toward Graham, who didn't stand. A box filled with paint towels and paint cans was at Graham's feet. "Why sitting, not working?" Tommy asked. "Where's the generator?" Graham replied. Tommy explained that he'd called Graham's generator people. Unfortunately, they had no generator available at this time. Graham nodded. He looked exhausted and frustrated. Nothing like he had a couple of weeks ago. It was like someone had replaced his young, happy eyes with those of a miserable old crone. Even his hairline looked less robust. It was terribly depressing to be confronted with this good man's emotional and physical degeneration. He'd been such a fun, wry, amusing person to have around the set at first. His problem was that he wanted to make something he was proud of. Tommy looked around at Graham's loafing, glowering crew and said, "Why is everyone sitting down? Let's move it, come on, let's get going." "I need a generator," Graham said, still sitting. He was no longer looking at Tommy. "This day, like all the others, will be hell with no generator." Tommy stopped and fixed upon Graham a long stare of intense disapproval. "Well, I'm sorry. Generator is not available at this time. I cannot create it for you here. I can make it out of nothing." Again, Graham nodded. "You never called." "Oh, yes, I did call." "No, you didn't. I called them, and they never received a call from you. They told me they had plenty available." "You're a liar, Tommy." "No," Tommy said. "You liar yourself. We call. They say unavailable. So you do your job, okay?" "Do my job." Graham played with the words as though they were little gobs of dough, and he was still deciding what to make with them. "How about you do your job?" Tommy began to walk away. Suddenly, he turned around and pointed his finger at Graham. "Listen to me, young man. It's not my problem. I need to prepare for acting, okay? I don't want to hear your problem." Graham grabbed a paint towel from the box at his feet and stood with righteous fury. "Tommy," he said, Tommy turned and Graham marched up to him and threw the paint towel at Tommy's feet. This was far more dramatic than it sounds. It looked as grave an insult as some 17th-century Frenchman slapping another with a white glove. He stuck his finger in Tommy's face. "You're a fucking liar, Tommy. You're a fucking liar." Peter Anway heard the ruckus and came out immediately. "Don't raise your voice on me," Tommy said, pointing his own finger in Graham's face. Graham knocked it away. "You know what? I fucking quit. You're a fucking liar, Tommy. I quit." Graham turned and stormed away. He motioned to his crew, who all snapped into action as though Graham were Toulon and they were his puppets. Tommy had never been confronted in this way before. He'd been yelled at, but not like this. Throughout the filming of The Room, Graham was the only person to directly call out Tommy for his lying. Tommy walked after Graham as he and his crew left. "Keep going, you sissy guy," Tommy said. "Ha, you sissy faggot, keep going, learn how to walk." Graham, to his credit, didn't turn and didn't acknowledge Tommy's insults. He and his crew were gone quickly. Tommy seemed to be hyperventilating out of his mind. I've never heard the word sissy more times than I did in the next minute. This was some of the ugliest onset behavior I'd ever seen from Tommy. It was despicable. There was no other word for it. He looked like a damaged wraith. He'd clearly lied, and he'd just as clearly been busted for it. It was as if he wanted to sabotage his own project. And Graham's sin was simply responding to Tommy like most of us wanted to. "You see how these people are?" he shouted. "They're monsters! Pricks! I give them job, and they don't appreciate damn thing!" Tommy could tell I was appalled by him. He could lie to himself all he wanted, but he couldn't keep lying to everyone else. How was it that he never seemed to feel any guilt? What kind of a person could do that? I wanted this episode to end. I wanted the film to be finished. I was actually still rooting for that at this point because I couldn't bear the thought of so many people working so hard for nothing. "Stop, Tommy," I said. "Enough." He didn't stop. He was pacing back and forth, snarling and muttering to himself. "They want me to spend money. They want to take my money. They tried to ruin my project." Everyone who didn't quit went home for the day, except for one person. A guy who'd been working the cameras, a guy, importantly, who didn't care much for Graham, now approached Tommy in the Burns and Sawyer parking lot. He was tall, with short, sun-bleached hair and a very laid-back manner. I pegged him as a former surfer now using the onset of his late 30s as motivation to get more professional. "Hey, Tommy," Todd Barron said. "I can be your DP. Tommy turned and looked at him. "I'll run it. I'll light the set. I'll do the camera. Just pay me a couple $100 a day. Joe, my camera guy, will stay on with me too." Tommy hired Todd Barron on the spot. "Now," Tommy said, "we see how good you are." 12. I'm not waiting for Hollywood. You can change the people, change the scenery, but you can't change your own rotten self. Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. After Tommy's meltdown in the car, weeks went by before I spoke to him again. When we finally did connect, he apologized several times for losing control. Although he was still planning his move to LA, he assured me that I could remain in the apartment. "I don't force you to live there," he said, "but it's your house, too." Thanks to what Tommy described as issue with street fashions, his imminent arrival kept getting postponed. The delays were fine by me. I'd been scanning the classifieds for apartments in my price range, an exercise in despair. Around Christmas time, I went up to the Bay Area to visit my family for the holidays. As soon as I got there, my feelings of melancholy and doubt about my future almost overwhelmed me. I pondered my options in the face of my dwindling savings and lack of income. I could afford a few more months in Tommy's apartment, but barely a month elsewhere. So that was it, then. If I wanted to stick it out in LA, I needed to get a job as quickly as possible and endure living with Tommy until I saved up enough to move out. After Christmas, Tommy called me at my folks' place and said he was going to spend New Year's Eve at the base of the Hollywood sign. I told him that sounded very interesting. Tommy then surprised me by announcing that he'd already moved to Los Angeles. He was, in fact, living in the apartment right now. "Wait," I said, "what?" "Oh," Tommy said, "it's very simple. At midnight, I'm going to yell, 'Tommy Wiseau is here! I will take over the Hollywood! Year 2000 is my year! Woo!'" "Not the sign thing," I said. "You moved to LA?" "Yes," he said. "It is my time." Tommy was too proud to admit that he'd be spending New Year's Eve alone, but I knew he was. I wasn't surprised when he started pestering me to come down to witness his Hollywood sign proclamation in person. Instead, I stayed in San Francisco, too depressed to do much more than watch movies all day. Iris had already warned me that pilot season this year was going to be rough. Reality shows had become so popular that the networks were scrambling away from traditionally scripted television like roaches from fluorescent light. Who needed actors when civilians were willing to eat bugs on camera? When I confessed to my mother that I was going back to LA to live with Tommy for a few weeks while I found another place, she braced herself against the nearest firmly mounted object. She thought I was now home for good. "I warned you," she said. "I told you. He's always been a weirdo. But now you know he's a weirdo. And you're still going back there? Come on, who did I raise?" This succeeded only in putting steel in my back. When I got Retro Puppet Master, I hoped I had kickstarted my strenuous climb to regular work. Things, of course, hadn't quite panned out that way. My mom, on the other hand, couldn't figure out why, after doing a movie, I wasn't already a big star. She wondered how much more time and effort this mega stardom of mine was going to take. The one thing that managed to cheer me up was a Christmas card from Iris. "You have everything it takes to become a successful actor in LA," it read. One day, right after Christmas, I got a call from my hippie friend, who had, in some ways, inadvertently instigated this whole mess by going toe-to-toe with Tommy on the phone a few months ago. I didn't blame him for wanting to confront Tommy about his bizarre need for secrecy. I knew he was trying to look out for me. The first thing my friend said, "I just saw a movie you need to watch, now." "What is it?" I asked. "The Talented Mr. Ripley." I'd seen previews for the film, but knew only a little about it. "Really? What's it about?" "Just trust me, Greg. You need to see this film." My friend, a longtime film editor, was also a self-proclaimed movie snob. So it was rare that he ever got that excited about anything that wasn't Casablanca or Cinema Paradiso. A couple of hours later, I met my friend at Festival Cinemas in downtown Walnut Creek, where he'd already purchased two tickets. I didn't know what to expect from the film, having never read the work of Patricia Highsmith, who wrote the novel Ripley was based on, and having never seen any of director Anthony Minghella's previous films. I've since rectified this. "So why do you think I should see this?" I asked while we waited for the previews to begin. "Just wait. After I saw it, I couldn't stop thinking about the move you're contemplating." I laughed. "My move? Why?" He didn't laugh. "You'll see." The last decade has brought about a general and much-needed critical rehabilitation of Ripley, which was simply ahead of its time. today a lot of people regard it as one of the best films of the last 20 years. It's certainly among the most beautiful. Italy hasn't looked so good since Fellini. The performances, too, are affecting and powerful. The first time I watched it, I noticed all that stuff, yes. But it had a far more piercingly personal resonance than that. From Ripley's opening scenes, in which Matt Damon's Tom Ripley vacuums up all the requisite bits of knowledge he'll need to convince Jude Law's Dickie Greenleaf that they were at Princeton together, I knew precisely why my friend was forcing me to watch it. Tom Ripley is someone who wants to belong to respectable society so deeply that he'll do anything. He loves Dickie Greenleaf's life, and this love turns into an obsession with Dickie himself. Tom is so skilled at reading people and situations that he's usually able to get what he wants, but he's utterly incapable of recognizing when he crosses the line into abject creepiness. Those who call Tom on his strangely obsessive, social-climbing tendencies are usually punished with violence. In this way, Tom's small, innocent lies become gargantuan, soul-killing lies. Murder becomes the foundation of the life he makes for himself, the life he refuses to let go of. Tom's brotherly attraction to Dickie becomes a spurned lover's rage when Dickie tries to cut him out of his life. When the film places Dickie and Tom in a small boat off the coast of San Remo, both yelling about what they believe their friendship really constitutes, my stomach squirmed in wormy recognition. I simply couldn't believe what I was watching. I couldn't believe how well it captured what Tommy's and my friendship had come to feel like. All of which made me Walnut Creek's least happy and most startled moviegoer when Tom grabs an oar from the boat and beats Dickie to death with it. I was stunned by the aftermath of this scene. Tom sobbing and cuddling up to Dickie's corpse on the floor of the small boat while bloody water sloshes over them both. It was one of the most intense and chilling things I'd ever seen. I looked over at my friend, who was already staring at me. He said one word over Ripley's desperate weeping. Tommy. That night, I came down with the worst flu I've ever had. I couldn't walk, think, sleep, or talk. I was vomiting every 30 minutes for the entire night and didn't get out of bed for 3 days afterward. By day 4, I was so weak I could barely lift my arms. I felt as though I'd been torn apart by microscopic locusts. My mother tried to convince me not to go back to LA. She failed. My hippie friend tried to convince me not to go back to LA. He failed. Patricia Highsmith, Matt Damon, Jude Law, and Anthony Minghella tried to convince me not to go back to LA. They failed. Now my body was trying to convince me not to go back to LA. It too failed. 2 weeks later, against all logic, I was in my Lumina and heading back to Hollywood. My apartment in LA was, at the end of the day, all I had going for me. It was my life raft. If I wanted to keep my dream alive, I had to live on the raft I had. Even if this meant that Tommy was, however briefly, my fellow passenger. The last thing my mother told me before I left Danville was this. You are at a crucial time in your life. You're 21 years old. Don't make the wrong decision. Wrong decisions can take an entire life to undo. You're playing with fire. Even my father thought I was crazy for going back to LA. He made it very clear, in fact, that my choice meant I didn't have a normal mind. But if having a normal mind meant reporting day after day to a job my heart wasn't in for months and years on end, then no, I didn't have a normal mind, and moreover, didn't want one. During the drive down to Hollywood, I thought about what could have been driving Tommy's renewed interest in Los Angeles and acting. I'd managed to piece together some of Tommy's acting trajectory. I knew, for instance, that he'd made his first attempts in the late 1980s when he was commuting to his LACC classes from San Francisco. After that, he'd moved to LA and bounced around Westwood, West Hollywood. He'd most likely begun living in the Crescent Heights place in the early to mid-1990s, which was also when he made his last serious push to become an actor. I'd heard a circa 1994 tape in which an innocent, exuberant Tommy chronicled his darkest acting hours, telling himself to try acting for a couple more months, and repeating to himself, I believe I have something to offer. I will do it. I really have something. To break me, take time. Take really time. By 1995 or so, however, his aspirations had fizzled, thanks in no small part to his no-nonsense LA acting teacher, Vincent Chase. After that, Tommy left acting behind and retreated to San Francisco. But he kept renting that LA apartment during the years that followed, which means his dream never really went away. It was simply dormant. After his San Francisco car accident, Tommy enrolled in San Francisco acting classes. He began Gene Shelton's class where, for the first time, as I heard him happily say on another tape, someone pick me for a scene partner. That someone was me. This random collision ended up changing everything for us both. I reached the apartment after midnight. My heart was jackhammering in my chest as I neared the door. I entered to find the entire room walled off by thick black velvet drapes hanging from the ceiling. It was like Tommy had turned one side of the apartment into a cable access television set. Apartment chiller theater. Before I could do the sensible thing and flee, Tommy's large white face peeked out from a gap in his black velvet curtains. Well, hello, stranger, he said. I was quiet for a moment. Hey, I said. Tommy stepped out from behind the curtains. You can see there have been some changes in apartment. This is now my private corner. No one is allowed back here, unless they have special access. I was more than fine with Tommy's private black curtain refuge. It was a little Adams family, maybe, but at least it meant I still had my own space. I'd been back in the apartment for only a few minutes when Tommy started asking me for my agent's contact info and the name of the headshot photographer I'd used. An image of him crashing into Iris Burton's office and her driving a wooden stake into his heart popped into my mind. I saw that he'd prepared a stack of envelopes pre-labeled with casting directors' addresses. I'd been in the same room as Tommy for 5 minutes, and already I felt suffocated. He announced that if I decided to continue living in the apartment, my rent would be upped. Instead of paying Tommy less than one quarter of the mortgage a month, Tommy's story was inconsistent as to whether he owned or rented the place. I was now to pay him half. You need to learn responsibility, he said. The school is over. This, too, was fine, since I didn't want to keep living my life in indentured servitude to Tommy. But it meant my already diminished savings were going to run out more quickly than I'd anticipated. I promised myself I would spend the next morning looking for part-time jobs and a new place. Already I could feel that the apartment's old, beloved energy had become warped by Tommy's presence. Tommy may or may not be a vampire, but I can say with surety that, at least in close quarters, he's eminently capable of draining the life and light right out of someone. While I was unpacking my stuff in my bedroom, Tommy stood in the door jamb. You look so skinny and pale, my God, he said. What happened to you? Are you ghost? I had the flu for 2 weeks, I said, like I told you. How much weight did you lose? 10 pounds. Tommy's hands went to his stomach. Well, you're lucky. Maybe I should get sick too, huh? I'm tired, I told Tommy, hoping to convey that it was time for him to head back to his vampire wonder cave. I'm gonna try to get some sleep. Tommy nodded, and I closed the door. Tommy stays up very late. I knew that at the time. When you don't live with someone, Tommy stays up very late is a curiosity, a personality quirk, an abstraction. When you live with someone, however, Tommy stays up very late swiftly defines the living dynamic. On that first night, Tommy spent an hour on the phone working on his diction with his friend Chloe. He could be heard repeating the phrases she was apparently feeding him. Yes, I think so. Where's the nearest telephone? I don't agree with you. All in his valiant, ongoing attempt to lose that ineradicable accent of his. The apartment was too small for me not to hear every syllable of every exchange. How is my voice tonight? Tommy would ask Chloe after 10 or 12 attempts. Less accent? I assumed Chloe's judgment was usually not affirmative, because Tommy would begin the process anew. After Chloe had had enough and hung up, or killed herself, Tommy busted out some English audio tape course he'd purchased. I listened to the rough chalk of Tommy pressing the play button. Then, "You think it's good, do you?" Tommy would repeat that. "You think it's good, do you?" Then another chalk, this time of the rewind button being pressed, followed by a whirring sound, and there the phrase was again. "You think it's good, do you?" Tommy would repeat it, his intonation so hopelessly wrong. Tommy played and repeated the phrase, "You think it's good, do you?" for over an hour. He did it at least 80 times. I know because that's when I stopped counting and put my pillow over my head. "You think it's good, do you?" This wasn't even a phrase the average native English speaker would say. Tommy should have been learning to say, "I'd like a refund for these tapes, please." I was fast asleep when my door opened and Tommy began doing pull-ups on the bar he'd installed in my doorway, which I'd somehow not noticed. It was 4 a.m. After a grunty set of 10 pull-ups, Tommy dropped to the floor with a thud and turned to pace around the living room like a caveman, after which he hit the chin-up bar again. Once he completed 4 sets, he closed the door. This is a nightmare, I thought. Either that, or Tommy was trying to convince me to leave. In the morning, I hit every service industry and retail establishment I found on Sunset, Hollywood, and Santa Monica Boulevards. I probably filled out a few dozen applications that day. Near the end of my quest, I found myself in a gay bar that wasn't due to open for a few hours. This wasn't the kind of bar in which hipsters drank elegant potions and talked about the film industry. This was a slightly feral bar with an older clientele and dungeon-like decor. "I wanted to see if you guys are hiring," I asked the manager. Well, they needed a bar back, which is the person who carries kegs and boxes of booze around and, per the manager, also occasionally clean the toilets. "I can do that," I said desperately. The man's eyes filled with strangely friendly pity. "I'm really sorry," he said, "but you wouldn't last one night in this place." At the end of the day, I walked 4 miles to drop off an application to work at a grocery store. I was told that the store didn't have any positions open at the moment, but that they'd keep my stuff on file. I'd never felt so defeated in my life. I spent the next few days walking around Los Angeles, hoping that while I was out, my home phone was ringing with prospects. Alas, it wasn't. I did manage to do some constructive things, one of which was load up on literature at the Samuel French Bookshop on Sunset. Then I signed up for 2 courses at Santa Monica College, the history of film and the history of theater. I'd resisted college for so long and been such an indifferent student in high school. I was a little stunned by how much I wound up loving both classes. I could thank Tommy, at least, for inadvertently making school an enjoyable endeavor. I spent a lot of time wishing I were more of a partier or a reveler, anything to break up the nights back in the Vampire Wonder Cave, but I wasn't. So while Tommy spent his evenings and nights, and very late nights, trying to lose his accent, I mostly read books with my door closed and my headphones on. One name I came across in several acting books was Jeff Corey, a character actor who'd been very successful in the 1940s. He was summoned to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, a committee he ridiculed during his testimony. Following his blacklisting, Corey became a highly sought-after acting teacher. He'd worked with Gary Cooper, James Dean, Jack Nicholson, Sharon Tate, Leonard Nimoy, Jane Fonda, and more recently, Shannen Doherty. Corey still ran a weekly acting class out in Malibu, so I made an appointment with him to see whether I could get in. The day of our meeting, my Lumina didn't start, and the bus to Malibu was as grueling as a Trans-Siberian train. Tommy offered to drive me to the coast, which typically took an hour. I didn't say anything about Corey or what I was doing in Malibu, for fear that he'd run into the house with an armful of headshots. We found Corey's house on the Malibu Cliffs, which overlooked Point Doom Beach, and I suggested to Tommy that, while he waited, he should take a swim or something. "I don't go in ocean," Tommy said. I tried to convince him that ocean water was actually very good for the body. Anything, basically, to keep him from curiously popping in on Corey's and my meeting. "Are you kidding?" Tommy said. "Ocean's not good for you. There are monsters that bite your ass." Tommy parked across the street and left me with these parting words as I started towards Corey's house. "Be careful. The jiggle business doesn't work how you think." Corey took me to his guest house, where he held his classes, and which had a panoramic view of the Pacific as beautiful as any I'd seen. Corey himself was irritable and cranky in the way that only old men can pull off and make adorable. I sensed that Corey no longer had that many eager young visitors, but the man still loved to talk. The first thing he told me was that Bob Dylan lived across the street from him. I immediately thought Tommy Wiseau was blocking Bob Dylan's driveway. The second was that Elia Kazan, who had been one of my favorite directors, was a shitty tennis player and an even worse loser. He told me tales about when he'd done In Cold Blood and Rod Serling's Night Gallery, and described working with James Dean on his walk the week before Dean was killed. I could take in Corey's charactery face, all white hair and big unkempt eyebrows, and listen to his anecdotes for hours. I remember thinking that if someone were to play Jeff Corey in a film, the only two people who could have pulled it off were Burgess Meredith and Jeff Corey. After we talked for a while, Corey asked me to do a monologue. I did, and it came out sideways. I was, I admit, greatly intimidated by his direction. "Sit with your legs closer together. Come on, young man. Stand up and take command." My monologue was rough, but Corey had mercy and invited me to take part in his class. The next morning, for the first time since I'd come back to LA, Tommy's curtains were slightly open, allowing me the chance to peer into his lair. It was as weird as I feared it would be. For a bed, Tommy had placed a regular twin mattress over a half-inflated air mattress, which meant he was sleeping at a tilty 30-degree incline every night. For pillowcases, Tommy was using old T-shirts. He noticed me pondering these Wazovian masterpieces of squalid home decor. "How'd you like my new creation?" he asked, as he held up one of the pillows. "This is my new thing." Scattered across Tommy's glass-topped desk were papers, his How to Lose Your Accent tapes, the tape recorder he'd later use in the room, exercise books, and yoga videos. His clothes were thrown everywhere. Half-empty glasses of water were sitting on the floor, some cloudier than others. Taped to the wall was a piece of paper, scrawled across which was one of Tommy's more mysterious mantras. I, me, you. Voice, body, mind. We all have that. That night, I started writing a screenplay about a young guy who lived with a lunatic in a house that had been built on a haunted Indian burial ground. I wasn't expecting to sell the thing. It was pure therapy. A few nights later, January 23rd, 2000, was the Golden Globes, known to Tommy as the Golden Globe. I was driving home from school, fighting my way through the limo traffic, and wishing desperately that I were flowing with it instead. When I walked into the apartment, Tommy was hanging upside down from the bedroom's door jamb pull-up bar like a bat. He was wearing his tank top and baggy sweats with multiple bleach stains. His eyes were closed. Being greeted by this vision of Tommy nearly made me sit down on the kitchen floor and quietly weep. The man bat spoke.
Take your shoes off. I get sick because of all these bacteria, damn it.
Bacteria, I said. Are you serious?
Yes, I am serious. I get sick because of all these bacteria sneezing like hell.
This was when I noticed that Tommy was wearing white surgical gloves. So it was official. Tommy had gone Howard Hughes nuts.
From now on, he went on, you must wash the hands immediately. Leave your shoes outside. Don't touch my things. I'm sensitive to all this stuff. Have respect.
Then Tommy curled up, grabbed the pull-up bar, released his legs, hung on for a moment, and finally dropped to the floor.
I'm starving, he said, wobbling a little as the gathered blood rushed from his brain. Let's eat something.
Tommy couldn't bear to eat alone. He would suffer through hours of hunger pain spasms to avoid the solitude. But I liked, even preferred, to eat alone. Sitting by myself at the end of a day was a way for me to think and reflect. Since I'd started living with Tommy, it had also become a useful time to plot.
I'm not going out tonight, I said. It's crazy traffic everywhere because of the Golden Globes.
Tommy shrugged.
Golden Globes? So what? I'm not invited. Who cares? Let's go eat. Go see feature movie. Something different. Find some chicks or something. I'm bored in this apartment. I can't be in cage all day long. Why you keep me in cage? I think I would get married soon.
Tommy was right about one thing. He was living in a cage. A self-constructed curtain cage called Tommy Wiseau's life. That said, going out and eating was bound to be better than spending another evening in my bedroom while Tommy alternated between English language mangling and pull-ups. I also knew if I stayed home, I'd be tempted to watch the Golden Globes. And that was only going to remind me of how distressingly far away I was from the life I wanted. We wound up at the Kookaroo on Santa Monica Boulevard, which had recently become Tommy's new favorite restaurant. From the moment we walked in, though, Tommy was off. Everything bugged him. The booths, the decor, the light from outside, the clientele, the small portions.
Is there shortage here? He asked.
When the server took our orders, Tommy started quizzing him on the chicken. How it was prepared, whether the chickens were clean, how many calories, why it was so expensive. The server walked away when Tommy dared him to find the most delicious piece of chicken they had. At one point, I had found all his goofiness entertaining, or at least tolerable, but now it was embarrassing. After our interminable dinner, we were standing in front of the Beverly Cinemas, trying to figure out what to go see. The Talented Mr. Ripley was still playing, and I somehow knew, I knew, that Tommy was going to suggest we go see it. If he did suggest Ripley, I decided I wasn't going to tell him that I'd seen it a month ago. He'd just complain about not having been invited. Tommy scanned the posters and stopped on Ripley. I was watching his eyes, and the poster just snagged Tommy's attention. Then he turned to me while pointing at the poster. "I want to see this movie." I'd seen several movies with Tommy. He'd always get bored and restless before it was over. Sometimes he got chatty.